There's a Zen story about two monks who were having a doctrinal argument about, and one of them was saying, they pointed towards a flag and said, "The flag is moving." It was flapping in the wind. And the other monk said, "No, it's not the flap. It's not the wind and flag that's moving. It's the wind that's moving." So they couldn't resolve this important issue. So they went to the Zen master and asked him or her what who's right? What's going on here? Is it the wind that moves or is it the flag that moves? And the Zen master said, "It's your mind that moves." So the idea of the mind moving and relating that to flag, that was kind of an introduction to continue on the topic of conceit, which we began last week. And one of the descriptions, kind of metaphors of conceit in the early Buddhist tradition, it's a person who's waving the flag of self. Conceit is understood to be involved kind of advertisement for yourself. You hold up a flag and say, "Look at me, pay attention to this." And some people put up beautiful red flags, and some people put up blue flags, and some people put up gold flags with glitter, and you know, just to get people's attention, advertise for themselves. And of course, with the election being so close by recently, we know very well the people who advertise themselves and how confidently people can do this. And someone who is considered enlightened, one of the descriptions of an enlightened person is someone who's lowered the flag of self, is no longer advertising themselves in any kind of way. And in relationship to this, it's said that the mind of an enlightened person, a Buddha or an Arhat, cannot be discerned. I guess in modern language we kind of would say they're inscrutable, but you can't read the mind of someone who's awakened. Mara, who's the god of death that goes around and searches people out, Mara can't find a Buddha, can't find something about a Buddha, something about an enlightened person where they can't be found by this being called Mara. And how I understand this is that the flag of conceit is no longer flying for someone who's awakened. So there's nothing advertising them. There's nothing, you can't pinpoint that person's mind and find something that's being held up and defining, "This is who I am." The mind is not actively involved in constructing an identity, making a me, mine, myself. Mind is not involved in trying to advertise itself in any way. Now, advertising ourselves is something which is very common. And one of the most common places you can see this, if you pay attention, you know, in yourself, is in your speech. If you ask yourself, why do you say what you say before you say it, or after you say it, or while you say it, why are you saying what you say? You might find that there's a lot of other reasons to speak than simply neutrally imparting some very important piece of information that the person listening needs to know. Usually when we speak, we're imparting much more than knowledge or information. We're trying to convey something to that person. And sometimes, if you pay attention, you'll find that sometimes in what you're saying, you're trying to convey something about yourself. You're trying to advertise yourself. You're trying to get that person to see you in a certain way. You're trying to present yourself in a way that makes you more presentable, makes you more interesting, makes you more acceptable, makes you more something that gets the person's attention. So in speaking, we're speaking in a way often where it's a statement about ourselves. And this is an example I've used maybe too many times, but it comes to mind when I come in here, because that's what happened. Was one day some years ago when I was going to come in here to sit and give a talk, I was coming in and I saw someone I hadn't seen for an old friend just somehow I hadn't seen for many, many years, and they'd come that Monday night. And so we had a little talk, but it was getting close to 7:30, it was time to come in. And that day I hadn't prepared a talk, or not much of a talk. So the last thing I said to the person before I came into the hall was, "Oh, by the way, I didn't prepare a talk tonight." Now, why in the world that person needed to know that? the last thing for me to say is my good old friend, I haven't seen for a long time, So that kind of resonated, since I just said that, the last thing I said before I came to sit down, it was kind of resonating still in my mind, and I realized what I was doing. And that was that I was trying to ensure that person saw me in a certain way, that I didn't show up here and give a lousy talk. And then that person would then judge me negatively for being a lousy Dharma talker. And so I was protecting myself. I was, saying, look, it might be a lousy talk, but don't judge me on this one talk. I'm bigger or better or than this talk or this, So I was kind of like, advertising, or kind of advertising is kind of protection, propaganda. Propaganda for Gil. So to look at why do we say what we're going to say when we speak to people? When we say, for example, when we exaggerate some wonderful thing we've done recently, I just ate at the most wonderful Chinese restaurant. And it could be innocent to do that. It could be we're just sharing our excitement and joy and delight. But sometimes, if you listen carefully to ourselves, it is a kind of advertisement, maybe. Oh, I'm a really good picker of Chinese restaurants, it says something about me, the fact that I'm saying this about me, that I've done. So how often is it that our speech is advertising ourselves? Now, the suggestion here is that it is not a moral issue. It isn't like you're bad for doing this. But because, and I think in general, people who do mindfulness meditation, really get into Buddhist practice, in a sense have no need for morality. And that's a kind of a radical statement. And the reason for that is that they have a different criteria that's actually much more sensitive for evaluating their actions than kind of abstract ideas of good and bad, right and wrong. And that is, for example, the psychic cost inside of us for what we're doing. We can feel that the very action that we're doing them, aside from the consequence they have, are often detrimental or harmful to us, irritating, in the very doing of it. So if you're very mindful, that becomes a more intimate criteria for your action than any moral kind of judgment. And you might end up making the same moral choice about what you say or what you do, but it isn't because of the moral valuation, but rather it's because you realize that you don't want to be stressed out. You don't want to do something which agitates that mind. What is it that moves? The flag, the wind, or is it the mind? I don't know, but the mind gets agitated. As we lift up the flag of self, the mind gets agitated. If we try to advertise ourselves, it takes effort to do that. It takes effort to construct and make some self-identity that we want to present to the world. And in that it takes effort to make it, it's actually more peaceful not to make the effort. And if you really love your peace of mind, then you might decide at some point, wait a minute, maybe it's not worth the benefits of waving this flag. Maybe I don't need to wave the flag. So the creation of a self identity is something which meditators need to look at very carefully. Many of us have an identity, and so we're men and women, so that's an identity, I suppose. And many of us, some of us are Americans and some of us are whatever we are. And it's kind of innocent to say, I'm an American. However, the sense of identity, which is problematic in Buddhism, is that movement of the mind which grasps onto that. That movement of mind then wants to defend that, wants to resist being seen in any other way. That movement of mind has a psychic cost. for us. It's tiring in the long term to do this. It's much more peaceful and easeful not to be involved with that kind of movement of the mind. So people who do mindfulness practice at some point start becoming sensitive to what their mind is doing. And are you beginning to do things with the mind that is agitating, that keeps the mind agitated and going? Now, someone who just comes off the street, just kind of a normal kind of person on the street who's never meditated in their life, might not have a clue what I'm talking about. Because the ripples of the waves, there's so many waves flagging that they don't even see the waves. They don't even know that there's an alternative. But when the waves get put to rest, when the flags get put to rest, then there's a perspective, the contrast of a peaceful mind versus an agitated mind. And the mind is always agitated, the person doesn't know it's agitated necessarily. So the opportunity from meditation is to begin to understand and watch and see the agitation as it arises, as it occurs, and to see the choices we have about whether or not to follow through on them, whether to let go of it. To watch ourselves in a conversation and notice when we start to want to say something, not because we want to impart some information, because we want to impart, to ensure the person sees us that we're smart, that we're knowledgeable, that we're up to date. You know, that really we really understand what's happening in Florida as well as anybody else. And let me tell you my opinion, because I know, you know. And our opinion isn't, you know, our opinion is interesting, you know. It's fun to talk about Florida. But how many times do we want to talk about something political like this, and it's tinged by our insecurity, and we want to kind of get our view out there, or it's tinged by our, you know, fear about how people are going to see us if we don't come across, or it's tinged by wanting to present ourselves as knowledgeable. Wanting to present ourselves as knowledgeable is putting up the flag of self and waving it. I read many years ago, I don't know maybe it's slander to say something, I don't know for sure, that Aldous Huxley, who was one of the great scholars and great minds of recent times, that before he went to dinner parties in Los Angeles when he lived there, he would open up the encyclopedia and read several entries in encyclopedia so he could show up at the parties filled with some esoteric knowledge. So then he would impart to the audience and display to people how learned he was. So the flag of conceit takes many forms, and there's two very general forms it takes. One is, the obvious one is, which is, we try to become something, we try to be something for people, we try to show ourselves, present ourselves as a somebody. And there's many somebodies you could be. The other form, which is maybe a little less obvious, is the movement of identification to be a nobody. In a spiritual circle, that's particularly more prevalent than outside. People don't want to be, somehow the ideal is to be a nobody, not to have conceit, not to kind of present yourself in some way, and to kind of be kind of Mr. Nobody. And so there's a certain conceit that goes into creating a nobody. And people sometimes will actively be involved in making themselves into a nobody by letting go of things inappropriately, letting go of their opinions, letting go of their decisiveness, letting go of their aggression, letting go of their sexuality, letting go of their anger, letting go of their thinking for themselves. There's many things. And sometimes it lends itself sometimes to some pathological occurrences in spiritual circles where sometimes people will then become a nobody, but then assume the opinions and ideas of the spiritual circles they're in and become somebody. They don't count for anything, but they only become something by association with something which is greater than themselves. And that have, you know, that's not just spiritual circles, it happens everywhere. It's people, such people. Sometimes spouses will be a somebody through their spouse. Sometimes it's through our opinions or our political affiliation or whatever we are. So to be a somebody or to be a nobody, both of them can be constructions, can be a kind of waving the flag. Though I suppose if you're being a nobody, then what you're doing is very actively trying to bury the flag. But you're still, the flag is not at rest. You're not at rest. You're doing something. Sometimes it's been said that the teaching of not-self in Buddhism is a teaching that anything that is not a negation of anything which is real. So you don't have to be afraid that teaching of not-self means that you have to let go of anything which is real. You only have to let go of your illusions. And what can be so frightening about that? The illusions about who we are often gets related to an identity we recreate. And the challenge in practice is to get underneath that and ask ourselves, can we live without creating an identity? We can have an identity, but can we live without creating one, manufacturing it, or adding to the identity which we naturally have and making it into something more than what it needs to be? One of the definitions of meditation or of practice is learning to leave ourselves alone. Another way of just talking about lowering the flag. Learning to leave yourselves alone. And this is actually, for some people, a very radical teaching, to learn to leave yourselves alone. As it's said in the Zen tradition, to not put another head on top of your head. Or how we say in America, too many cooks in the kitchen spoils the soup. Too many selves in here spoils your soup. So, so meditation practice is learning to leave yourselves alone, which entails learning how you don't leave yourselves alone. And it's great to sit in meditation and to watch how the mind judges, evaluates, makes preferences, gets involved in storytelling, gets involved in constructing a sense of self, gets involved in reconstructing a conversation of what you should have said so that people see you a certain way. To watch how certain experiences arise in meditation and how we take it personally. An emotion arises in meditation and we assume this says something about me. This is, you know, depression arises. And this is, we assume this says something about ourselves. We take it as a personal failing or a personal event. And so then we're embarrassed to show it to people that people know. Or we try to present ourselves a certain way to kind of present ourselves in a good light, given the fact that this emotion has arisen. But thinking that the emotion says something about us personally. One of the great liberating aspects of mindfulness practice occurs when you can have an emotion, whether it's a great, wonderful, pleasant emotion or a great, wonderful, unpleasant emotion, and you cannot take it personally. Just, oh, it's not necessarily my emotion that's happening, it's an emotion that's happening. There's crummy feelings arising. But you don't necessarily say, oh, I'm the one who's crummy, I'm the one who's lousy. And that's a kind of a conceit, it's kind of getting tied into creating an identity, which is often quite invisible to us, because we're so quick to take things personally. This says something about me. But it only says something about you if you say so. You have to be involved in the creation of that saying, that statement, and that idea. It's possible to have an emotion arise, and it just floats there, it's there, and your awareness, you yourself, in a sense, feel quite independent of it. It's just passing through like the movies. To see a thought the same way, to see that a thought that you have doesn't have to be taken personally. That you can have all kinds of bizarre thoughts, all kinds of interesting thoughts, wonderful thoughts, and they don't have to be, their existence, their presence, doesn't have to be taken as some statement about who you are. You don't have to identify or take them personally, these thoughts. I mean, they're not happening to anyone else, so isn't that you're supposed to just kind of ignore them entirely? But there's a movement of the mind which latches onto them, which grabs onto them or resists them, which relates to identifying with them, taking them personally, saying, this says something about me. And so in meditation, the opportunity is to look at what's going on there, not only to see what's happening in and of itself, but to see this extra little movement of effort, of energy, of engagement, which identifies with it, which takes it personally, which holds on to it, which makes it sticky with us, which comes often with a lot of other, it's a magnet to a whole bunch of other evaluations. If this particular emotion is me, well, that says a lot of other things about me. It's a magnet then for other things. So to sit in meditation and to learn to watch very carefully the movement of the mind to hold on, to cling, to identify. So when the Buddha was awakened, when he just was liberated, there was a wonderful passage where he says, one of the first things he said was, and I have it, I don't have it with me, so I'm going to say it wildly wrong, I'm sure. And I say that not because I want to reassure you, but anyway. But the last statement was, tricky, isn't it? So the Buddha said, the house builder has been seen, and the rafters have been broken, and no longer will I create another house. And the house that's been seen is the house that's constructed, is the house of self-identity. The Buddha was still lived quite happily, was quite functioned quite well in life, and was very peaceful and very, very creative man, and did a lot of wonderful things. You know, the Buddha was a great poet. You know that? He did a phenomenal amount of poetry. If you collected all the Buddha's poetry and put it into one book, I think it would be a really big volume. So, you know, he was, you know, he kept functioning quite well after his liberation. But the house builder has been seen. And the house builder has been destroyed. There's no more building of the sense of self in the Buddha. So the question for you and the question for me, for all of us, is how do you advertise yourself now? Or maybe you don't. I mean, maybe you're one of those rare people who doesn't have a flag to wave. But how do you advertise yourself? How do you want other people to see you? How do you want to see yourself? How do you not want to see yourself? How do you not want other people to see you? Who do you think you are that you don't want other people to see? All those belong to the area of conceit. What would it be like if you weren't advertising yourself? What would it be like if you entered into a conversation with people and the conversation was not colored by your needing to appear any way with people you were talking to? You didn't have to impress them, you didn't have to protect yourself. You could just be there in a peaceful way. So I keep relating this to talking because I think it's really one of the more challenging places for us to do the mindfulness practice. But I think one of the places that's very revealing, very helpful to do it. And so to use the foundation of a sitting practice, formal meditation practice, to help us become more sensitive to what goes on within us when we speak. The choices that the semi-conscious choices that go into our speech acts. So that's enough for me today. So, comments? Questions? Yes.
Along the lines of the subject, I thought about how the sense of self is hardwired into our language, and how we start so many sentences with I. And in terms of some languages, don't I tried it for a while one day.
and then here in California, you're supposed to make I statements. That helps another problem. So it's kind of hard to get out of it. But it is true, when I was living in Japan, the Japanese will often not use the personal pronouns in conversations. You understand in context what it implies. And so if you just go up to someone and say, eat, you know, they understand what you're saying, let's eat, for example, you know, let's going to eat or whatever. But it was very hard for me to get a hang of when I was speaking Japanese. So it became really obvious to me, this tendency, because I would start every sentence, and when I was in the monastery there, with watashi wa, which would basically translate into, as for me. Because that's how I knew how to speak. And so, like, so, and the, you know, they just kind of scratched their heads after a while. They thought it was kind of cute. So I would say it a little bit differently, which is a Japanese way of kind of expression also, because in Japan, you very seldom say no to someone. You say, oh, it's different. So I would say it a little bit differently. That the notion of self is not hardwired, but it's part of the software. And we don't necessarily have to get rid of the software, but we have to realize it's software. Because most of us take it as the hardwire, take it as hard, you know, the hard fact, as that's the way it is. And what meditation does is teach us that it's really the software. And software is actually quite flexible. And you can play with it, and then you can use it as it's useful.
I guess the software uses our software uses
if you want to cut in.
I mean, it's kind of fun to experience stuff that
we
or if I
we. Yeah. Sorry?
One.
Yeah. I think it's very interesting to experiment sometimes with, like you're saying, if you have a normal way of speaking, always referring to I, for example, experiment for a day with a different way. But do it carefully, because it used to be, I remember in the 70s, there were people who came back from Asia and, you know, thought that there was no self, absolutely, and they refused to use any pronouns at all but self or I. And, you know, you asked them how they were, and they said, oh, there's a lot of tension here. You know, and how are you? Well, there's a lot of, you know, all this, you know, feelings and emotions and thoughts kind of floating around. But how are you? And, you know, you seem really angry. You know, so you can drive your friend Fatty too, if you know.
Hill?
Yes, please.
Will you repeat what the Buddha said toward the end of your talk?
So it's something like, house builder, you have been seen.
Pardon?
House builder.
Oh.
House, the builder of the house. House builder, you have been seen. The house is, the rafters have been destroyed. The house has fallen down.
Oh.
No more will you build a house again.
Thank you.
Please.
One of the things that occurs to me is that during the day, in the work that I do, I notice that everything is about propaganda and advertising. We want our company to look a certain way so that Wall Street will think a certain way, so that our stock price will be a certain way. We want our CEO to say a certain thing at the appropriate time and place. We want our department to look a certain way to other departments. And
which requires you to look a certain way.
Exactly. And, you know, when you were talking about this subject, I just started to reflect on how much of my day is about, or we even call it, you know, image management. And, you know, and then I also just take that down to myself and how do I present my manager. And then honestly, I feel like a lot of the times I don't drop that role. It's, you know, it's not a role that I drop easily. I'm glad we're talking about it. I'm really not sure. I guess mindfulness is the first way to begin, but for me sometimes it does seem quite automatic.
Uh-huh. So I think that's a very important statement, that in certain fields of our life, sometimes at work, that image management is a very integral part of what we're expected to do and present ourselves a certain way, or if we want to succeed, kind of the rules of the game are certain, to advertise yourself in a certain way so you can get ahead or you get your company ahead. And so the whole day is made up of living, is acting, and basically. And then how easy is it to drop at the end of the day? Certainly if you go into a certain area, a certain domain of life where certain rules are applied, you might have to, if you're going to do your job, you have to play those rules. But you understand them to be just a show that's put on for a certain game. So and you can drop it when you leave work, or do we continue? Many people identify very strongly with their jobs, and so it's not so easy just to leave it behind once they leave their job. Yeah.
That's why I love going to company picnics or company dinners, because you meet people, you meet their spouses, you meet them with their kids, you have completely different people.
I kind of vaguely saw in the Chronicle a little article about Silicon Valley companies now who are very proud about having a sauna right in the middle of their company quarters, head offices, is that right? And so, you know, and it's a wonderful way to kind of drop all the personas. The board meeting is in the sauna. And you didn't even take acting classes. I mean, we're not prepared for these roles that we're supposed to live. Yes?
I think of the retreat by Bernie Glassman, maybe, that he does in Brooklyn, where people become, where the Sangha becomes street people for 5 days or 7 days. They're given $5 at the beginning of the retreat, and they are supposed to make it from there on their own. And I've talked to some people who don't know anything, that it's supposed to become a experience for their life. Suddenly be in a position where people walk by you and they don't see you. They're in a different universe than people are, in a sense. They never realize how crisp that time can be.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Please.
One thing I was looking at is how to relate to myself or my mind and doing this flag waving. Thinking about something that happened today, which is similar to your work a couple of years ago. I don't have to go back quite as far. I was playing tennis with these friends that I don't play tennis with all the time, except I haven't played in a long time, but I was playing very poorly. And so I just had to tell them that I hadn't played in a long time. And I would see it come up, and then I was kind of laughed off, but it wouldn't go away. So the whole, 2 hours, I'm having. So I'm thinking, what's a better way to set that up than to just kind of, it's almost like I was resisting it or didn't know what I was doing. It seems like I'm wanting something. I really want to say it, and I want them to acknowledge it.
I think that's some wisdom there. The The first thing that came to mind in response to you, what you could do was, maybe not necessarily the wisest, but certainly one option, is if you feel this great compulsion to say something to your friends so they see you in a certain way, is to confess that. Say, let me tell you something really amazing that's happening to me right now. It just, you know, this is something else. Isn't it funny how the mind works? You're my good friend, but I really want to impress you. And this is the way I want to do it, is I want to tell you that I haven't played for a long time. That would pop the bubble pretty quickly. Take the pressure off you. So that's one, I think that's actually quite useful, to actually, that kind of personal confession, if you have friends who are willing to put up with it. another way. There was Joseph Goldstein once said that, you know, he was talking about how it is to be a teacher. He says it's hopeless because some students, he says, you know, think that you're really great because you're great or whatever. And then if you try to be really humble and be like everyone else, then you're really great because you're humble and being like everyone else. And you can't get out of it. But so what's one thing is you tell them. The other thing is what the wise thing you said, I thought, was try to find, go under the surface of it, and what is it that you need? What's the emotions and feelings that's stimulating it? And what's that, you know, one thing is to look at the hand, the flag that's waving, and the other is to look at the hand. And what is it the hand wants? And, you know, what's the emotion? So in this situation, it might be fear or insecurity. And then to address the insecurity directly, and then you can almost ignore the flag then. And then really be honest and direct in dealing with the, you know, the underlying emotion. And then maybe it needs something, and maybe you actually need something, and maybe you even need something from your friends. It's realistic and appropriate. And maybe you could actually, in more healthy ways, ask for that and get it. Thank you, everyone. I hope that was useful. And may your flags at least be colorful.